We're going to get started here on the Committee on Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs. Today is Wednesday, January 31st, and we're going to start with the Department of Employee Relations and Faith. I'm not going to attempt to pronounce your last name, so if you'd come to the table and pronounce your last name for your first and last name for the record, and then go ahead.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Faith Zwemke, and I am the Pay Equity Coordinator at the Minnesota Department of Employee Relations. And I have been the Pay Equity Coordinator for the past 18 years, and I greatly appreciate your willingness to have a presentation today about pay equity. It's very rewarding and enjoyable work, and I feel fortunate to be able to do it. If you have your handout there, I was going to prepare a PowerPoint, which I, of course, did, but you don't have a screen, I guess, so we'll just go through basically the handout with the little boxes on it. There are several responsibilities that are mainly mine as the Pay Equity Coordinator, but the two main ones are to provide technical assistance to 1,500 local governments who are required to report under the Pay Equity Act, and then to analyze those 1,500 reports. They report 500 each year for compliance. And today I'd like to split my remarks into three parts. The first part is just a little bit of background about pay equity. The second part about the process that's involved in administering the law. And then finally a little bit about results of what the law has accomplished. If you look at the second slide on your first page there where it has a little map of the United States, that's the illustration of the wage gap that exists across the country, where females typically make 70-some cents to the dollar that males make. And we've highlighted Minnesota. If you have a magnifying glass, you could read it, but it says 74 cents. This was done a few years back, and it kind of fluctuates a little bit, but that's pretty much what it is in Minnesota overall. Then the next slide is our solution to the wage gap problem in Minnesota was to pass legislation. At the time that this was done, there were some other areas of the country where lawsuits were brewing, and we didn't want that route. So in 1982, a pay equity provision was passed for state employees, and this was under Governor Al Quie. And I'd like to just take one moment here to introduce my manager. Chad Tui is my manager. He's the compensation manager and assistant state chief negotiator at the Department of Employee Relations, and he is the one that is responsible for making sure that the state, for state employees, complies with pay equity. In 1984, the Local Government Pay Equity Act was passed, and that is the law that I work with. So that was passed under Governor Perpich. And one of the reasons that that law was passed, all of you I'm sure are familiar with Senator Linda Berglund, and one of the things she discovered in that period of time was that she knew some employees, some women that worked for Hennepin County, and she learned that they were eligible for food stamps. And you would think that, you know, a person in a government position would have a decent enough wage, that wouldn't be necessary. So that was one of the reasons that she was so supportive and instrumental in passing the Local Government Pay Equity Act.
If I could interrupt you for just one moment. It is official. We now have a quorum, so the Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs Committee is officially called to order. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that kind of describes a little bit of background. The purpose of the pay equity legislation is in this mouthful of words, and that is to eliminate sex-based wage disparities in public employment in this state. That is the underlying principle. That kind of takes care of the background. I'll move on to the process, and this is a slide that says it's probably the last one on your first page, where it talks about a two-part process, job analysis and pay analysis. I'll spend just a moment on each of those. Job analysis is where you can actually compare different jobs. You can compare the cook to the custodian, the superintendent to the teacher, the business manager to the nurse. And some people hear that and they go, well, how can that be? That's like comparing apples and oranges. Well, it turns out if you flip the page on your handout that you can compare apples and oranges because they have common factors. They both have weight, they both have calories, and so on. So it's a similar process that we use to compare jobs, and the common factors in jobs are identified in the pay equity law. They are skill, effort, responsibility, and working conditions. So those are the ones that we use to evaluate jobs. And it's, I think it's when I go out and speak to local governments, I always make this point. I say, if you don't remember anything else about job evaluation, remember this, and that is that you are evaluating the position and not the person. It's very difficult sometimes to separate ourselves from that, but we're looking at the content of the job and not the individuals doing the job. So if you look at the next slide there, it's a little bit small, but it says sample pay ratings for Minnesota state jobs. We look, I just offer this as an example. These are two state positions, but could easily be in local government. The factors are know-how, problem-solving, accountability, and working conditions, slightly different terms, but the same general idea. And you'll notice at the bottom that there is an office specialist position, and the rating for that position is 117 points. If you look at the maintenance worker, the rating for that position after putting all those factors together is 111 points. So what we've done now is taken you beyond the concept of equal pay for equal work. Now we're talking about jobs of comparable value or comparable work points. So we can take different positions, come up with a rating, and say now we have a common ground to analyze pay, which is the next part of the process. Before I do that, I just want to note that the local governments are all required to analyze their jobs. Many years ago, we provided this booklet called the State Job Match System. This is now online, of course, in the electronic age. And this is a booklet where they can look at descriptions for state jobs and piggyback their jobs onto that and come up with a point rating. And the importance of this is that it's free and it does not require them to go and hire an outside consultant. They're free to do that if they choose, but it's not a requirement. And also, the only requirement about job evaluation, once they have done it, is that they maintain it. They don't have to continually redo studies or do them once every few years. All they have to do is do it once and then maintain that system. Many of them try different systems and have done more than one study, but that is their choice. That is not a requirement of the law. So then moving on to pay analysis. This would be the third page of your handout. Remember those two jobs that we just evaluated and got points for? Well, now we can look at the pay. And if you look at the, it's a little bit hard to read, but let's look at that office specialist. This was in 1991. The salary for that position or that class back then was $6.43 an hour. The maintenance worker, remember these are jobs with similar points, $9.02 an hour. Obviously an inequity. Then in 2004, when we looked at these jobs again, those salaries were equitable. And if you look at that ratio column on the far right, before pay equity was implemented, that position, 71% to a dollar, 71 cents to a dollar for the male position. As you might suspect, the office specialist was a female-dominated class, the maintenance worker, a male-dominated class. Another way to look at that process, and I'll just wrap up on that here, is if you look at the next slide, you see that graph. And what that illustrates is before pay equity. On the bottom, we have the job analysis, or the points, and along the left-hand side is the pay. And you can see that it really, every single time, at every single point level that's there, the female classes represented by the Fs are paid below the male classes. There's really a dual wage system. It appears that one system for male classes, another for female classes, and this really shows you a gap, the wage gap that existed. But then if you look at the next slide, or next one on that page, my pages are a little bit different here, so I have to flip them around. After the state implemented pay equity, then we now have a single wage system where we don't have the wage gap. And to give you the definition in the Local Government Act of what this means is that local government has achieved compliance when female classes are not compensated consistently below male classes of comparable work value. So what that means is that overall, when you have those points that are the same or similar, the pay should be the same or similar. However, it is not absolute. On occasion, you may have a deviation from that, but still be in compliance. That consistently below is an important term. So to determine if they have met that standard, we're looking at the last slide on page 3 now of your handout. There are tests for compliance. There are 4 of them. Completeness and accuracy, salary comparison, and there are 2 ways that we do that, by a statistical method or not a statistical method for the smaller jurisdictions, a salary range test, and exceptional service pay test. And we have free software online. The local governments can plug in their numbers, and the software will churn out the results. And those results yield a score on each of these tests. So if they pass on that, then they are in compliance. And I might note here, too, that the software now allows the department to require electronic reporting. So we've eliminated a lot of the paper and the mailing costs. They can use the software to report electronically. And then we also invented a kind of a smaller version of a reporting form for the very small jurisdictions. It's not necessary for them to use the software because there's not enough statistical points for them to use it, but we did make it easy for them to report online too. I'll just point out that we do have publications, which we've done over the years. The Guide to Understanding Pay Equity Compliance and Computer Reports is online, and so they can use that to determine whether or not they've achieved compliance. And then if you look at just the back page of your handout, I did include a sample reporting form. It says Pay Equity Implementation Report at the top. And I just wanted to point out that the reporting form is very simple. It's a 2-page form. It'd be longer for jurisdictions that have more job classes. But this is essentially what they can use and print out from the software and also from the smaller version of that that we have put online. Then to move on from that, those tests for compliance are the nuts and bolts of what determines whether or not they have any inequities. If they do have inequities, they automatically get a 90-day grace period to correct them. They can also ask for an extension on that. Well, and finally, let's just move to the third part, some results. And if you look at the bar graph on your handout, let's see, I think this would be on the last page. This is what happened in state government. In 1982, women made 74 cents on the dollar. And then over the years, as pay equity was implemented, that gradually improved. Finally, we get to 2002 when we last ran these numbers. And I don't ever mean to be grandiose, but this is really, I think, the most amazing statistic in the world about the wage gap. So females that work for the state of Minnesota make 97 cents to the dollar that males make who work for the state of Minnesota. And when this came out, you know, I was practically doing cartwheels, although I never could, even when I was young. But I was waving the pages around, and one of the young attorneys in our division said, well, gee, Faith, you know, that's really wonderful that they make 97 cents to the dollar, but where is my 3 cents? So I guess we can always look for further improvement. Then finally, the compliance status, we just had 500 reports submitted in 2006. It's much harder in local government to kind of track that exact ratio of pay, because there are so many different types of jurisdictions, so many variables in compensation. But we certainly do have a high rate of compliance. Currently, 89% of those who reported in 2006 are in compliance. 6% remain out of compliance at this point, and then the decision is in limbo for 5% due to some clarification on data and that sort of thing. And I would like to just show you that the second to the last page in your handout that says examples of inequities identified in 2006 reports. This is the page that I love to read. It's in the, we do annually a report to the legislature. We just did it in January of this year on compliance status in local governments, and so it's an excerpt page from that report. But it shows you examples of where inequities were identified, and these jurisdictions were out of compliance. If you look at the bottom, Before the inequities were corrected, the average pay for the female classes in this example was $13.79, and after the example, it was $16 in some cents, and the difference was over $2. So those are the kinds of results that occur in local governments. And many times, you know, they're in compliance before they report. They have the software. They scramble around right before the end of the reporting, or right before the reporting deadline, to make sure that they're in compliance if at all possible. We do have a DVD that is a training video and also explains the compliance requirements. And also online we have instructions for completing the pay equity report form. And I think those results, both in state government and in local government, are really indicative of the strong commitment that the legislature has maintained to pay equity. If it were not for you people supporting the law, then these kinds of things would not be a reality in the local governments. And I'll pause there, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions from members? Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to go through this chart, and I think you used the word average, but as I read this, correct me if I'm wrong, are these not specific examples rather than averages? So like this first line, administrative assistant, a report was filed, the administrative assistant was receiving $19, they were out of compliance and the adjustment on this specific person. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Representative, yes, that is correct. These are individual classes. Most of them probably have only one person in them, but some have more.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, then the other question I have, again, on this chart is noticing a few items here that I'm not quite sure belong under local government, so you might be able to help me. Bartender lockup. Liquor store clerk, can you help me why those are in this report?
Ms. Demke.
Madam Chair and Representative, yes, many local government cities have liquor stores.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions from members? Representative Schumper.
Madam Chair, Ms. Demke, sample hay ratings? Why hay ratings?
Madam Chair and Representative, I always identify with this too, because I was brought up on a farm and I baled plenty of hay. But that is the name of the consultant group that the state used. So we do a lot of piggybacking off of that. We have piles of hay and cows and so on to illustrate this.
Further questions from members? If not, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, next on the agenda, we will have Patty Tangi from Pay Equity Coalition of Minnesota. Please come forward and state your name for the record and go ahead.
My name is Patty Tangi. I am the current president of the Pay Equity Coalition of Minnesota, and I'm going to be directing your attention to another packet, hopefully stapled together. The first report being earnings gap in the United States. So you should have another group of reports in front of you, and throughout my remarks we'll take a look at those. Thank you for letting me speak today. I represent the interests of not only the Pay Equity Coalition of Minnesota, but another organization near and dear to my heart, Business and Professional Women Minnesota, in this coalition. The coalition is a loosely held together group of women's organizations, labor unions, and individuals, not bound together by any contract, but by our interest in addressing the wage gap between male and female full-time workers in Minnesota. Our work includes educating the public about wage disparities and public policy initiatives designed to strengthen current pay inequities in our system. Some of our members were instrumental in passing the Local Government Pay Equity Act and are here today should you have any technical questions about the early days that I can't answer. They are Bonnie Watkins, the first pay equity coordinator of the state of Minnesota, and Aviva Breen, who is the past director of the Legislative Commission on the Economic Status of Women. I'd like to call your attention to the first handout that's entitled Earnings Gap in the United States. The graph on the top depicts the earnings gap between full-time year-round female workers and full-time year-round male workers in this country. The gap, as you can see, has closed partially, and in the 2004 numbers, almost reached 77% to the dollar a man makes. And we think that part of the closing of that gap is we do have had equal pay legislation on the books for about 40 years, and also Title VII of the Civil Rights Act makes it illegal to pay to discriminate against women on the basis of pay and promotion. And also during that time, men's wages have actually decreased, so that has had an effect on the wage gap. The second report I wanted to call to your attention is Earnings and the Earnings Gap, which is basically the same data, but we actually have some salary information here. And in 2004, in our country, the wage for women was $31,223, and the wage median wage for men was $40,798. I should clarify that. This is the median wage of all full-time workers in the country. And again, the gap is 76.5%, and strangely enough, that gap hasn't closed to any significance according to the National Committee on Pay Equity. But the next chart actually has some Minnesota numbers, and as you can see, Minnesota, the women in the workforce, in the labor force, is actually much larger than in the rest of the nation. 66% of women aged 16 years of age and over are working, as opposed to 57.5% of the U.S. women. And another interesting number is the median wage for women in Minnesota, $28,708, which is actually slightly larger than the median wage for women throughout the nation, which is $27,194. Also in your packet is a brief history of pay equity monitoring and enforcement in local governments, at least from the Pay Equity Coalition's perspective. And a lot of the members in our coalition, like I said, are still very active and can help answer any questions that you have. As you may guess, in addition to paying women fairly, the Local Government Pay Equity Act has actually helped women become economically self-sufficient, meaning that there's less strain on the welfare system and Minnesota care. Ms. Wemke's presentation has described a few of the pay raises that are a result of the inequities found in the pay structures of local government, local units of government. Their job match system, the one found in the Department of Employee Relations website, is one way to evaluate jobs in a gender-neutral fashion, ensuring traditionally jobs traditionally done by women are paid fairly. Local units of government can choose that job match system or any that they prefer, but sometimes they feel that that requires them to go to outside consultants, which of course is not necessary. Pay Equity Coalition continues to its advocacy work in this area in hopes that pay equity reporting will actually enter the private sector. The wage gap, where a larger impact on the wage gap can actually take place. The objective of the Local Government Pay Equity Act is to address the undervalued jobs in a general neutral fashion by evaluating them on the basis of skill, effort, working conditions, and responsibility, and we think it's working. And that concludes my remarks, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Questions from members? I do actually have a question, and I'm not certain if it would be for you or for Ms. Zemke, but what if somebody disagreed that they did not feel that the chart and where you place workers were adequate, and that maybe someone was getting a higher pay for a different effort? What would they do? How would that process work?
I will defer to Ms. Zemke.
All right.
Madam Chair, Faith Swimke again. I think you're talking about whether if they disagreed with their job evaluation rating. In other words, they have 200 points and they say, I think I should have 250 or something like that. There isn't anything in the law that requires a local government to have an appeal process. So it pretty much comes down to be a local dispute. There's a lot of local control in the pay equity law, giving the local governments the responsibility to assign points to jobs. The state really doesn't do that. The only time we would intervene is if, for example, let's say we identified an inequity. We said, well, this female class with 200 points should be paid the same as this male class with 200 points. And they said, oh, no, the male class really has 250. Then we would not concur on that unless there really was some substantial support for a different change in points. But it really is a local matter. That dispute about job evaluation points is a local one that they really kind of hammer out at the local level. Sometimes the unions are involved, sometimes not. But there isn't a whole lot. I do get that question from employees fairly often. One thing they can do, and that a couple have done over the years, is that if they really feel the system has been manipulated based on gender, they can file a complaint with the Department of Human Rights. And on occasion, they have intervened in that. Not often, though.
Okay. One follow-up question to that would be, You mentioned there's not really much pay equity enforcement done in the private sector. Is that anywhere in the country or just here in Minnesota, or is that just something that would be too difficult to measure? Ms. Tangi.
The enforcement is all complaint driven right now, and if people bring suit either under the Equal Pay Act or under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, and they can file a complaint through the EEOC, but if you are a public employee, you can file a complaint with the Department of Human Resources. So there really is no recourse, and in the private sector, women often don't know that they're underpaid because there is no public document that outlines the wage structures within their companies. But they hear it through the grapevine or various sources.
Sure. Other questions from members? Representative Bissman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. Is it, and I know this is theoretical, but is it theoretically possible for the wage of the higher paid employee to be lowered to meet pay equity? Or does the statute prohibit that practice?
Madam Chair, Representative, the statute does not prohibit that. I can tell you that really doesn't happen. On occasion, I have seen a few instances where they may have frozen pay for a short while so that the other classes can, quote unquote, catch up. But several years ago, quite a few years ago now probably, you might recall Senator Pat Piper. She had some complaints from some deputies in her county, Moore County, and she said, you know, they're complaining that their wages haven't gone up and all the money is going to the female classes. So I did a little study for her and determined that over that span of years, I think it was 5 or 6, that indeed the wages for the male classes had significantly increased. They had not gone down. It was, you know, in the double digits, the percentage of increase. So, and if you look at wages overall, In local governments, there are at least 220,000 employees in local government. They really are not declining.
Further questions? Representative Shumpert.
Ms. Wemke, Madam Chair, could you say, has the state effort had an impact on private sector wages?
Ms. Wemke.
Madam Chair and Representative, I don't think we have any data to really support that. It probably would be anecdotal at best.
Okay.
So we don't have anything that really says, you know, that because the local governments are paying better, that the private sector would not have those employees or not be able to recruit them. I can tell you that in Canada, pay equity legislation does affect the public and the private sector.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you both for coming. All right, next on the agenda, we have Representative Sertich. Please come to the table. All right, I would entertain a motion that House File 180 be recommended to pass and move to the General Register. Representative Beard, move. Representative Sertich, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Beard, and committee. It's great to be before you today. This first time I've had a bill up this year, so hopefully I'm not too rusty on it. House File 180 originally came to me from the city of Hibbing. They have a Hibbing Area Redevelopment Agency, which is an agency that was set up actually in Minnesota law in 1961. I wasn't around then. We looked at research. You don't know why it was actually developed as an agency back then, but it was. And this agency, this division of their local government, they no longer use, but it has some assets to it. So they've been looking to dissolve the assets and move it to the Hibbing Economic Development Authority, which is the authority they use these days there, which is appointed community citizens, and some of the council members sit on this authority. So they have to come before the legislature to dissolve a local agency. In working on this, actually, and producing this bill, the idea was broached and discussed about, well, maybe there are other local agencies or authorities that may need to be dissolved in the future, and should we take them individually, or should we develop a process for them to allow them to do that and streamline it so we don't have bills in the future needing to come, local bill with a local agency needing to come back to the legislature. So there was an amendment that was drafted to have a statewide process if you so chose to go that route. I believe somebody has a copy of that, I hope.
Mr. Chair. Sorry.
It's all right.
Representative Sertich, we do have its Amendment H-180A2.
Yep.
And if it is your intent to do that, I certainly would move that amendment.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, it's really up to the committee if they'd like to have a streamlined uniform process for everyone. I'm happy to carry that. Just a point of information on that, I ran this by the League of Minnesota Cities, and they initially don't see anything wrong with it. They're going to run it by some of their lawyers to see if there are any issues with it, where we would have time between this bill passing this committee, hopefully on the floor, if they have any issues with that as well.
Thank you. Representative Biskin.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. Madam Chair, I like the direction that the amendment is going towards, Representative Sertich. I do believe it's better to look at global processes rather than every year. And you know the issues. They come to us all the time. But, Madam Chair, if you do move this, and I would ask that you do so that we can have some discussions, because I do have some questions here. I'm inclined to support the amendment, but I do want some clarification probably from staff. So I'd like to have that discussion.
Absolutely. So I would move that we amend House File 180 with Amendment H-180A2. It is before us. So, Representative Biskin.
Okay. Madam Chair and Representative Sertich, I don't know if I should direct this to you or if the staff would be better. All right. So I'll direct it to staff then. All right. At the majority leader's suggestion. All right.
She drew it up. Madam Chair, Representative Biskin. This was her suggestion. And
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Thiessen, as I look at lines 1.8, 1.9, that whole first section down through 1.11, are there any local agencies which are directed to exist because of state statute? Because if we allow this language, then it would look like even though statute says you have to exist, we now put into law where they say, no, we don't want to.
Ms. Thiessen.
Madam Chair and Representative Viskins, I'm not aware of anything that any entity that's been created as a mandate of state law, and if it were the situation, it would have been a special legislation uncoded somewhere. The law that's being amended is a general law that says municipalities, the county, town, whatever the listing is, for definition of municipality in the statute, may create these. But I'm not aware of any that has been required to be established by state law.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. That helps, Ms. Thiessen. Ms. Thiessen, another question. If the local agency was created by the local municipality, its elected officials must have seen a need for that agency to exist. Am I not correct in reading that first sentence of Subdivision 7 saying that the dissolution is solely at the discretion of the agency which was directed to exist because of the municipality? You see what I'm saying? It sounds like the municipality creates the agency, but this sentence allows the agency to dissolve itself no matter what the municipality wants because it doesn't ask for their approval.
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative Biskins, it states that the board of the local agency or the governing body, the municipality, so in one sense, I think you're correct that the agency could move to dissolve itself if the, say, the city created it, objects, but there's going to be a public hearing process. So, but I think technically, yeah, it could be the situation.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, then Representative Sertich, you may want to amend this language. So it's the municipality which creates and it's the municipality which has the power to dissolve, I think would be a better bill to move forward with than letting the municipality, the elected officials create something and then the agency dissolving itself no matter what the municipality wanted in the first place.
Representative Sertich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Biskins, I think that's a good idea and perhaps Ms. Dyson could suggest some how to change that so that potentially we can have the municipality be the one deciding that. That's a good point.
Madam Chair, if you give me a few minutes, I'll find the parts to strike.
We do have other questions, so I will move on to Representative Solberg while we wait for the language.
Madam Chair, and my question is a little bit about joint powers agreements as well. And maybe does this affect if you have something with that's created with the joint powers agreement, would all municipalities have to agree to that dissolution as well?
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative Solberg, you're correct. They can be created by through joint powers, so this doesn't address that. Another good point.
All right. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two quick questions, if I may. First, to Representative Sertich, the assets and liabilities in this that are being transferred, are we talking tens of dollars, hundreds, thousands, an idea?
Representative Sertich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Baird. They're quite a plat of land in an industrial park in Hibbing.
Oh.
And sold the usable lots over a period of time, so we're not talking about a significant amount of money.
And Madam Chair, the second one is probably for staff or for some of the veterans around here. Apparently, when the legislature previous to ours required statutory action to create these things and statutory action to take them apart, they must have had a reason for it. I mean, sometimes it happens without a reason, it just happens. But I'm just curious as to whether there was some thinking that went into this, and we're trying to undo it now. Perhaps it would be good for us to know that before we pull this apart. Any recollection?
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, I was around in 1961, but I was pretty little. In terms of, there probably is some history as to why this type of agency was authorized to be created, and the definitions of the area that these can be created in limits them to rural areas and apparently the Iron Range. This is not everywhere in the state. It's another type of economic development entity that was authorized to be created after HRAs had been authorized at some point. EDAs were authorized. There are a number of these different types. And to be honest, I don't know how they overlap in their powers and duties, but what I would say is that authorizing them to be dissolved doesn't get rid of the state statute that authorizes them to be created. It allows any particular one, if it's met its purpose and the city's decided they don't need it anymore, to get rid of it. But it's not getting rid of the authority to create one.
Okay. Okay. Well, I remember in our city council history in Shakopee, we created an HRA and then transferred it to an EDA and actually had discussions about a port authority without any legislative action. That would be why then, because we're metro area and didn't fall under all those. So.
Madam Chair, one of the things that requires this prohibiting, what prompted all this in the first place, is that unlike an HRA, the statute doesn't actually authorize them to be dissolved, and there was the 1950 AG opinion. This is sort of, it took me a while to piece together why they can't just dissolve themselves, but back in 1950 there was an HRA that wanted to dissolve, and the Attorney General told them, you can't, the statute says you can't. I mean, that there's no statute that allows you to do it. 1953, the statute was amended to put in a statutory provision saying, yes, you can be dissolved or dissolve yourselves. This is similar, and that's the analysis that the city attorney for the city of Hibbing went through in trying to figure out how do we dissolve the agency, and the city attorney found the AG opinion. He was the one who pointed it out to me because I didn't know about it, and So he just said, HRAs have authority to dissolve. We don't. That's what we want. In Hibbing's case, it was specific for their agency. Hibbing didn't ask for a general law. They asked for their own special law. So.
Thank you. I think that's very helpful, actually.
All right, Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Sertich, just a couple of other questions on the original bill. I find the use of the term area interesting because typically when area follows a municipality, it talks about a broader region than just the boundaries of the municipality. So I guess my question is, does the Hibbing Area Redevelopment Agency and the Hibbing Economics Development Authority exercise power in this exact same jurisdiction, or are there some differences?
Representative Sertich.
Madam Chair, to my knowledge, they only envelop the city of Hibbing. And when they say Hibbing area, I think it was more to the effect that Hibbing is one of the largest land area cities in Minnesota. It encompasses a lot of miles, actually, it did not have authority over anything but the city of Hibbing.
Representative
Sertich. One final question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Sertich, I know that typically in this neck of the woods, it's the Garden of Eden and everyone's getting along and, campfires and all. Are we stepping into a family feud? Is there some bad blood between these two agencies where one is whooping on another and so we're going to come to the rescue here?
Representative Sertich.
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, very good observation as far as what happens sometimes on the Iron Range, but I can assure you the Hibbing Area Redevelopment Agency does not exist anymore. It exists in name only. So there is no feud here. They only have the Economic Development Authority that is it's constituted and has members right now. So there will be no bad blood. The City of Hibbing, the Hibbing Economic Development Agency signed off on this. The city of Hibbing wants it. The attorney is the one who has been, for the city, has been pushing this forward. So the only folks that may get mad are the folks back in 1961 who started this in the first place.
I do need to apologize to Representative Lanning because I did pass over him a few times, I think. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just want to make sure that I understand this correctly. The Hibbing Area Redevelopment Agency was established under a permissive law that said the local city could do that, but that law is silent on ability to dissolve. That's point number one. Point number two, the Hibbing Economic Development Authority, was that established under a special law? Does it, for example, does it have port authority powers? Representative Sertich?
Representative Sertich.
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, I do not believe it does.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my the question would be, if the Hibbing Economic Development Authority was established or given powers under statute, does that further complicate the ability to transfer assets to that authority?
Representative Sertich or Ms. Dyson?
I can take the first swing at it, Madam Chair.
Representative Lanning.
I do not believe it was the HEDA, the Hibbing Economic Development Authority, I do not believe was happened under statute. I think they developed that locally on their own. So I don't think you'll see anything in statute under that. And I believe in listening to Ms. Dyson before, and she perhaps can answer this better, we have permissive language to allow folks to start their own economic development authorities, correct? Is that somewhere in statute?
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair, Representative Sertich, yes.
Okay. And Madam Chair.
Representative Sertich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we have a way for them to dissolve eventually, too, or there is not going to be an issue between them getting, if we're answering Representative Lanning's question, that there won't be a problem with them taking the assets.
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair, I'm not aware of it.
Okay.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It might be a good question for Ms. Dyson for staff to just double-check to make sure. My community went through this. We dissolved an HRA, formed a new economic development authority with port authority powers, so we had to have a statute to do that, and also established a housing authority. And so I'm sympathetic to what you're trying to do here. I just want to make sure we don't find a problem here in hidden in the statute somewhere that causes further difficulty. Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Schumper.
Madam Chair, Representative Sertich, I feel like I'm missing part of the picture here, being a new person. I don't understand what's to be gained here. I mean, is there something gained by going from one agency and creating this new one or having created it?
Representative Sertich.
Madam Chair, Representative Schumper, it's what the City of Hibbing wants. I don't know. I personally don't know the difference between the EDA or ADA. Besides the letters, but and I don't sit on your committee or I'm not too familiar with their authority. So the short answer is it's what they want. So
okay.
I'm doing what they want.
Further questions? Representative Dominguez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a good experience for me as a freshman, as my colleague here mentioned. I appreciate this information because there's a lot of times we don't understand what's going on, and it's helpful that we're listening to this bill. There's different ideas, and we like to see what our Iron Range folks are doing up there. And it is a good experience. It's just a comment, so thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Sertich.
Thank you, Representative Dominguez. It's always good to keep an eye probably on a Siren Ranger, so that's probably a good point. But overall, my intention, just to repeat and probably to give Ms. Dyson and Representative Biskin some time to figure this out, is streamline the process if it ever has to happen again, but also have the transparency of there to be an open hearing and to allow the public some input on this process.
Thank you, Representative Sertich. Ms. Dyson, do you have the language for the proposed amendment?
Madam Chair and members, it's pretty straightforward and simple. I just was looking for everywhere in the subdivision the board was referred to, meaning the Board of the Area Redevelopment Agency. On the amendment A2, page 1, line 8, delete everything after the period, and line 9, delete agency, comma, or. Then line 11, delete board or, which is at the end of the line.
Discussion. Representative Biskin.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, if it be the will of the author of the amendment and the author of the bill, I'd like to move the amendment to the amendment. Actually, I'd like to move the amendment, Madam Chair.
Representative Biskin, it actually, I moved the amendment, right. So it would be easier if I just incorporated that amendment into the amendment, if that would be all right with you.
Absolutely, Madam
Chair. All right, so I will incorporate that without objection from Representative Sirdis.
Oh.
All right, so further questions? All right, with that, all those in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted. All right, further questions on the bill?
Madam Chair,
Representative,
I don't know if we need to address the issue of joint powers. Do we, Ms. Dyson?
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative Solberg, I was looking at the section that talks about the joint powers and ARAs, and what I would prefer as a drafting matter to get it right is to have time to look at it, because I'm not quite clear how it structurally works. Just because there's a whole section on how joint power entities are set up, and I'm not sure how to draft it right here at the table. But I believe that it is an issue that would need to be looked at, but I need some time.
Madam Chair, that sounds reasonable to me, and if you find it to be not an overwhelming issue, then I'm not overwhelmed by having it addressed.
Ms. Dyson, I have a question. Because this is just dissolving these agencies, are joint powers actually called agencies? And so this would allow joint powers maybe by 1%. Is that the issue here that we're trying to get? I just want to have a good handle. Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if I understood the question, but there is a section in the ARA statute that says two or more municipalities by agreement can exercise jointly any of the powers of an ARA. So they can, and they can set up a joint powers ARA board. And is that answering your question?
Yes. Question? Representative Solt.
But Ms. Dyson, I think the amendment that we adopted deals more than just ARA boards. Doesn't it say any agency? And that's, I guess, it's pretty broad, and that's fine to do that. But, you know, my concern was, well, I'll take it to the very extreme. What if the joint powers board and one of them wanted to pull out of a very major agency, not just an HRA, say a Western Lake Superior Sanitary District type thing? Or
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative Solberg, to clarify, this subdivision is going into a section in the ARA statutes, and there's a set of definitions in the ARA statute, and one of them is local agency, which defines it as the municipal redevelopment agency created under this section. So this does not apply to an HRA, an EDA, a port authority, or anything else. This is only ARA.
Representative Sirdis, given the concern about joint powers, how would you like us to proceed?
Madam Chair, I'm at the will of the body. If you would like to lay the bill over so that it could be worked on, or if the will of the body is that it moves forward. I know the next stop of it's in the Rules Committee, and I know the chair well of the Rules Committee, and I think I would promise that he wouldn't take any drastic action on something, and if there's a big problem, he'd probably even send it back here if need be. So it's really up to you all to decide that.
I don't think that that's that controversial, given the fact that it is your intent to, you know, work on this language and address the concern. So I'm prepared to vote on the bill. Representative Beard renews his motion that House File 180 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Hearing none, motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thanks for your help in making this a better bill.
All right. Members, we just have the minutes to approve, and with that, then we will be finished. So I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes.
So moved.
Representative Dominguez moves the minutes. Can we do both at once? We have to do one at a time, I think. So of January 22nd. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. A motion for January 24th, also Representative Dominguez. Representative Dominguez moves the minutes of Wednesday, January 24th. Any questions or concerns? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none. Motion is adopted, and we are adjourned.